two announcements, and then we'll come back to us.
And then some mechanics.
So the first announcement is that we're going to have, in this semester, three more classes. So the final official class will be, what, the 13th of December? Something like that? Whatever that Wednesday is, 12th or 13th. I will be here on the 20th or 21st, whatever that is. That will not be an official class. What I'll be here to do is simply to answer questions and have a discussion. Since there has not been enough of that going on, and I just thought just to leave a whole slot open for that seemed like the right thing to do. And I know some people want to travel, and I just wanted to arrange both things. So, three more classes. So we'll start reason. We'll get into observing reason, but won't get very far. Second announcement, of course, tomorrow and Friday is our Arendt conference. You may not know the names of the presenters, since what we decided to do is to choose the people who I think will be making the agenda about Arendt for the next 25 years. That is, I think these are, thinking of Andreas across the hall, the five best young people working in this area. They're all tremendous. Roy Tsao is working on a book. I've read several pieces by him, and every piece he writes is just fantastic. Dana Villa has already produced, I think, two of the best books there are on Arendt. And is doing a book, working on Hegel and other topics. I mean, Dana Villa is making himself, I think, one of the most interesting political philosophers of the country. Andreas Kalidis is coming out with a book on Weber, Schmidt, and Arendt, on the exceptional moments in the political. And his ideas about Arendt are fascinating. Suzanne Gottlieb has written an exquisite book on Arendt and W.H. Auden. It's a beautiful, wonderful book. And I really look forward to hearing what she's going to do as well. And Kirstie McClure is, I think, we tried to hire her here in the politics department and failed. She's just simply one of the best young political philosophers in the country. So I just think it's going to be a terrific conference. Encourage you all to come for as much as you can manage. Okay, announcements. Mechanicals, a couple people have asked me about essays and what I want from an essay. So just to repeat, I think what I've said before, the standard length of an essay around here is about 20 pages, double space, Times New Roman, 12 point, you know, that kind of stuff. Hegel is really hard. So what I'm looking for is an extended bit of commentary that really shows you mastered a stretch of the text we've been looking at. I mean, if you're ever going to be able to use Hegel to do interesting things, you have to understand him first. And I'm thinking that that's what this course should be for, understanding him. Worry about doing things with him later. So a paper that gets it right, if you're working on a particular section, it is advisable that you consult two or three commentaries or essays on a particular area so that you can see the different approaches and feel your way into those differences and feel what you want to say about them. So what we're looking for is very high-level, intense commentary. Nothing grander than that. You should either come see me or email me about your topic suggestions. If you have any queries, come talk to me about it. So that's the general lay of the land. Any other questions on mechanics? Yeah?
When would you get that paper in order to get a grade for this semester?
21st December. Anything after that, I promise that you will get a grade for this semester. If you get it in by then, if you get it in later, you will get it back as I have a chair, or I have a pile of things I have to read. And as you can see, there are a lot of people here. So if each of you do 20-page essays, that's about 800 pages worth of reading for me. Figure it out. Okay. Any other questions? Anyone want to be a marker? Okay, good. My account of self-consciousness. So we're going to talk about social descriptions and the idea of consciousness. I consider these, for reasons I'll come to, absolutely central bits of text. Indeed, there's a general kind of debate within the Hegel literature about whether it's the master-slave that's the central moment or the section on the unhappy consciousness. And people like Hippolyte, Jean Paul, Stephanie Rosen, lots of commentators think that it's the unhappy consciousness. And I fall more on that side of things for reasons I will come to. This really is a crucial moment in the text. But let me get there. And let me do that by first going back to where we left off last time. My account of self-consciousness, what I hope distinguished it, argued that for Hegel, the way I read master-slave dialectic as an account of self-consciousness, was there to demonstrate that self-consciousness for Hegel is neither merely social nor merely individual. That my fundamental claim I thought I tried to make last time was that self-consciousness is exactly the relationship between the interpersonal and the intrapersonal, between the subjective and the intersubjective. And that therefore the master-slave account, what it means to show, is to show how a primitive self-relation is mediated by another. But the fact so that self-consciousness is always, as I tried to put it, itself a kind of social institution. But nonetheless, the fact that it's a primitive social institution, nonetheless, that mediation is meant to begin or presage a deeper grasp of what makes an action or a thought or indeed a life mine. So after all, I tried to suggest that we were trying to be able to see how we might say the word I. And that saying I thought required a more complicated relationship to self than we had seen so far. Well, I want to underline this thought before pressing on by supplementing what I said with some helpful claims that I found in a book I've just begun reading by Patchen Markle. It's not on your reading list, called Bound by Recognition. And Markle is actually, if I had a sixth slot in my Ren conference, it would be for Patchen Markle. His book is terrific, and I'll have a lot more to say about his ideas when we come to Antigone, where he puts a lot of his strength, but some of what he has to say about the master-slave is helpful in reminding us of some of the core theses there. Let me return to the question of death and finitude. I made much of, in the account I gave you, of how the fear of death shapes the slave's consciousness. It's the fear of death, as represented by the master, that leads to the repression of desire, that learning how to repress one's desires leads to the possibility of reflective evaluation of our desires. It leads to the thought of work, where work is desire held in check, desire restrained. And of course, it does so because in work there is a substitution of my desire by the desire of the other and the like, all of which are connected to this notion of the fear of death. Now, as Markle points out, the upshot here is not Heideggerian being towards death, that the relationship to death that's being staked out is of a different character. In the Heideggerian being towards death, the crucial thought, of course, is that only when I acknowledge my finitude, acknowledge that my death is certain and all that sort of stuff, can I authentically lead a life, because only the thought of my death individuates me. That only my death. So death is the condition, according to Heidegger, for mindness. This is clearly not the case for Hegel. On the contrary, the heroic confrontation with mortality is what occurs in the life and death struggle. That's what both of them are doing. They are taking up the idea of their finitude, staking it, and willing to sacrifice themselves for it. So that the life and death struggle is one in which there is indeed an heroic confrontation with mortality. And it's just that which leads to the life and death struggle. But, and hence crucially, Hegel contends that that relation to death is futile. That won't get us the kind of relationship to our finitude and mortality that we require. Well, what is the response we require? Markle says that Hegel's lesson here seems to be that the idea of mortality on its own, is in fact an insufficient figure of human finitude. The thought of mortality is an insufficient figure of finitude. Of course, in Arendt, we know that's to be true. That's why she says natality. That's her thought of finitude. So, death alone, and for Hegel, indeed, natality alone, won't give us the right notion. And indeed, in Hegel's case, the problem is he thinks that that thought of death alone is precisely what leads to the sovereign ideal of aristocratic self-will. Of thinking of death as the greatest threat and the only thing is in fact what leads to the idea, the false idea of sovereignty, of independence of myself from every other. Right? somehow, if I can grasp that, then I am truly independent. And that does seem to be what, indeed, Heidegger does think, and therefore is wrong about. If that's right, then what is important about the fear of death here is less its association with mortality itself, then the fact that it takes place in the midst of a confrontation with an unpredictable and threatening other. It's the problem of the other that, which is to say, my non-self-sufficiency, not my me mortality, but my non-self-sufficiency, my availability to the other. So the occasion for the fear of death is the experience of intersubjectivity. And from this perspective, self-consciousness's fearful surrender, while indeed a confrontation with mortality, is equally a confrontation with a very specific kind of it, namely a kind of mortality that is inflected by the notion of human plurality, that we share the earth with others, necessarily, and that we are in various ways dependent on them. So, that the misfall that Hegel's worried about is not the thought that I'm immortal, but that I'm sovereign, that is independent of every other. And it, therefore, it's not an accident that this section is called Independence and Dependence. Because that is really what the stakes are. And we will see more of exactly that question of otherness and dependence and relationality as the stakes of our finitude throughout the chapter on spirit. That the chapter on spirit makes those stakes clear. Secondly, it follows, therefore, that the stakes of the master-slave relation is not life and death, but, as I just said, independence and dependence. And working out the meaning of our absolute dependence on others, which I've been underlining from the get-go, is going to have to be the toughest work of the book, since we are also free and independent. And figuring out how those two moments connect will be much of the work of the book, and indeed we'll see the work of what we have to talk about today. Now, the slave is therefore central here because he's the one who acknowledges his dependence. And indeed, he acknowledges dependence twice over. He acknowledges fully and exquisitely his dependence on the necessity of life for self-consciousness, that he's not free of the empirical world, that he's not free of nature. And furthermore, he is dependent on the other. And therefore, you may say in the master-slave relationship, it's the slave who disproportionately bears the weight of the thought of dependence. And it's in that thought of dependence and bearing that weight that he's bearing the thought of finitude, not in another way. Just as the master, of course, disproportionately bears the moment of independence. The master, because he is dependent on one he does not recognize, is insulated both from his dependence on the other and his dependence on nature. That's what is achieved by having a slave. So, thirdly then, and crucially, the master-slave relation does not any longer operate on the basis of a face-to-face relationship. If it did, it would be nothing but a prolongation of the original struggle for life and death. So what changes, what makes the relation different from the struggle, is the mediation of the thing, of nature. And that the master and slave stand in different relationships to nature, and therefore the thing, is what mediates their relationship equally to one another. So their relationship to one another is mediated by the thing, and the thing is mediated by their relationship to one another. So it's a significantly three-part structure. Now, the lesson to be learned from this is that let's ask the question, what is misrecognition? What is the basis of misrecognition? How does misrecognition work? And the point about misrecognition is the master is not fundamentally making a cognitive error that social subordination. So there's a story to be told. It's told about colonialism, about slavery, about that. Namely, whoever is the dominator doesn't recognize the humanity of the person dominated, as if there's some feature of this other person that the slave master or the colonial master just didn't notice was there. And if they were just cognitively better equipped and could see that the person talks like them, speaks like them, therefore is like them, then they would recognize them, then they'd be equal. So on this standard identity politics story about recognition and misrecognition, misrecognition is the failure of someone powerful not to notice a fact about the worth or value of the subordinate. That just seems an implausible story about how domination works. Rather, these practices are themselves, these practices of domination are rooted in the failure of the powerful to acknowledge something fundamental about themselves. Specifically, their failure to acknowledge or bear the full weight of the fundamental human condition of finitude, which is their dependence on the other. So it's not they're missing something about the other, it's something missing something about themselves that goes wrong. And indeed, I can tell a long story here because I'm working on the problem of torture. But thinking about the problem of torture is the torturer doesn't misrecognize the torturee as not human. It's that what the torturer wants to do is make the existence of that other nothing, to remove the other as other so that the torturer can be sovereign. So what we cannot bear about our lives is not that we're not angels and will live forever. What we cannot bear about our lives is all the levels of our dependency on others, even on others that we despise, don't like, etc., etc., etc. So it's that notion of finitude, I think. And that's why the slave master, the patriarch, the colonizer, the racist, the misogynist, they are not making a cognitive error. They are, I believe, and I think this is right, self-deceived about themselves. Or rather, attempting to sustain a belief about themselves, which is in fact unsustainable, hence the wrath of this position. Hence recognition, when it happens, if it ever happens, is not going to happen because the slave jumps up and down and says, I'm here, look, look. So there are deeper, more complicated issues, and that's what I keep trying to suggest that Hegel is trying to get at. This failure about our own acknowledgement of our own finitude. Okay, and that will, of course, have lots of repercussions for one's understanding of social power, of mastery, and the like. Okay, that's the extra thoughts I wanted to get out about the master-slave. Now, of course, that said, it is equally true, and I don't want to ignore the fact that at the end of the chapter on the master-slave, there is still the fear of death, and that fear of death has something to do now with some notion of transience that cannot be written off. That will certainly be part of it. Okay. Any questions about the master-slave before I transition further accounts of self-consciousness. Yeah.
I know a little bit here, but also in, say, your essay on the dialectic of enlightenment, mm-hmm. talking about the master-slave dialectic, it's the idea that the slave isn't a dead-end position because the slave is going to learn something and recognize something and is going to be able to move forward, whereas the master is kind of this dead-end trajectory. In the restatement you just gave us, it sounds like, well, in theory, the master could learn something if, what I guess I want to ask, what would it be for the master then to realize his own dependence on a slave? Would this be a learning process? Is this just impossible?
It's that we're going to... The answer is the slave's still going to have to do all the work for the master. It's just that way. And what's going to happen is getting right a better thought about the meanings of human independence and dependence until we can see certain structures as necessary and inevitable. So what we have to come to see is that certain relationships to others, right, are necessary conditions for the possibility of being a self at all. And we're way far away from that. But, point one. Point two, which allows me to do part of the transition, the master, I've separated these out into classes, but now we better unite them into one self-consciousness because the moment of mastery and the moment of slavery are components of every self-consciousness. So there's all of us are going to be in the position of having to learn this, because all of us contain both moments. And Hegel makes that absolutely explicit right in the section on Stoicism, when, you know, he gets both Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius in there, right? Both the slave and the emperor. Okay, we get it, right? Everyone has the dual structure of consciousness. So master and slave, this is the segue into today's topic, master and slave now have to be recognized as elements of every self-consciousness. Can we in fact have an ordinary, common variety, philosophical way of talking about that? Namely, transcendental and empirical consciousness. And indeed, that's what I want to say in the next three sections are all about, on transcendental and empirical consciousness. So the separation, so the master and the slave turn out to be both forms of self-consciousness, and self-consciousness, at least up until the moment of Hegel himself, probably thereafter, too, is bound up by these two moments, master and slave. So we have to learn how to integrate the two sides of ourselves. That's why I said earlier, all of us are subject to the repudiation of our dependencies. And indeed, the more dependent we are, the more that repudiation can break out. It is not an accident that most murders are domestic. Who else would you want to kill except your lover? Why kill a stranger? It's pointless. You want to kill the other who binds you, because you really are bound. And that can become intolerable. I'm bound to that. Which is also why, again, just thinking out of in terms of why there is such viciousness in domination. What the standard recognitive cognitive accounts, not recognizing the other's humanity, don't explain, they explain viciousness as simply oversight. I treat the other as a thing because I don't recognize it as a human. That doesn't explain viciousness, that explains indifference. The viciousness of domination only comes because there are deep stakes. So the issue is going to be about divided consciousness and about us as divided consciousness. Let me start thinking about how we can transition into this. Everything takes longer than one supposes, doesn't it? It's harder than one thinks. So I suggested that Hegel's master-slave relationship is Hegel's meta-psychology, that is, the primitive intersubjective constitution of self-consciousness. If that's the case, it's Hegel's meta-psychology, then the three forms of Stoicism, skepticism, and the unhappy consciousness represent three fundamental attitudes or stances or modes of self-comprehension which the slave consciousness adopts in the light of its divided character. That is, remember, at the end of the chapter of Master Slave, the slave was getting some idea of its own independence from its recognizing that it makes the thing. Just so happened the thing is not its thing, it's the master's thing, but it makes it. And I'll come back to how that gets us to where we're going. So these are three fundamental attitudes or stances towards our divided consciousness, towards the fact that we are both independent and dependent. And that's what self-consciousness is, this dividedness, transcendental and empirical. Power of negation and power of unable to negate. And hence, these are three attitudes through which slave consciousness attempts to make sense of, which is to say, to try to dignify its bondage or dependence. Now, if this was a different course, we would say that these three forms can be thought of in Nietzschean terms as three forms of the ascetic ideal. And I mention that, A, because the ascetic ideal is just about equals Western self-consciousness for Nietzsche. And I want to say that these three forms represent Western self-consciousness for Hegel, and that they both have the same thought that this slave morality, same word in both of them, presents our fundamental ways in which Westerners in post-Hellenic life world have understood themselves necessarily and unavoidably. In Hegel's case, this chapter presents a phenomenological genealogy of the ascetic ideal, which is equally, I'm now saying in Nietzschean terms, coextensive with the formation of Western subjectivity. Now you can see why lots of writers think this is the key rather than the master-slave. The master-slave sets up the structure of self-consciousness, but self-consciousness as lived by each and every Western soul post-Homer, roughly, is going to have this double character. So the history is going to be the education of the race in the enjoyment of work, and that history is equal to the odyssey of the unhappy consciousness. So, now, saying that, I do want to insist, therefore, that Stoicism, skepticism, and happy consciousness should be thought of as not, although I'll say a little bit about the historical setting of each of the three moments. Hegel flags it wildly. Right? Stoicism is obviously late Hellenic, early Roman Stoicism. Skepticism is Sextus Empiricus. And the unhappy consciousness, the bit of it we actually get, there are actually three moments, the bit of it we actually get is medieval Christianity. Nonetheless, and therefore there's an historical progression there, nonetheless, these are three transportable forms of understanding. So that, as I'll try to convince you, that Stoicism is simply the thought that only thought is truly actual. And you may think of this as what Descartes or Galileo think about the meaning of mathematics. You may think that that's what Kant thinks is true in ethics, that my action is good if I think it's good, that is, I act in accordance with the moral law. It doesn't matter about the world, it's my relationship to the moral law, the world drops out. And indeed, all, or almost all, ethics that has any notion of duty or any transcendental conception of the good is stoical, because it abstracts from the body, from the world, and thinks of goodness as a relation of the will to itself. Skepticism, we know, is kind of everywhere. And the unhappy consciousness is simply that the belief that my true self is located elsewhere, which we know that nearly all our fellow citizens believe, along with the fact that Elvis lives and the rapture is imminent. But Kant thinks it too in the notion of the highest good, that Marx thinks it in the notion of communism, that any time you think of a beyond as where all the problems are solved and your true self is to be found not in the here and now, but in the self you would have in this better deserving world, then you are living a form of the unhappy consciousness. Okay, let's see if we can now figure out how we get from master-slave to Stoicism. Here's one version. I'll give you a couple of versions. Why have one transition? Yeah. The slave has to overcome his fear of death and his dependence on the other. He does this by vacating the thing-like character of his subjectivity. Which is to say, he does this by vacating the body itself. I have to, if I'm such a consciousness, deceive myself in a certain way and cling to what is most disembodied about me. Namely, my capacity for thought. The authority, and this is the crux of the matter, the authority of the master is never present in consciousness, that is, in my thinking thoughts. The master can own my body, but the master cannot own me. There's a bit of me that is always going to be on the master, right? So, you know, the master may beat me, whatever, but in my mind, I know I am free. And you read any account of living under the Soviets, that thought of the freedom of thought is everywhere. Bako Havel talks all the time that at least I could think my own thoughts. They could make my body do. That's Stoicism. I'm free to think what I want. No one can touch that bit of me. So the abstract freedom the slave's freedom of thought that becomes a kind of order giving. And the thought that we can obey our own thoughts, self-determine ourselves, come together in this notion of thought. If we realize the ultimacy of thought as our true being, then we no longer desire either. We no longer think of desire as what's connecting us to the world, that we forsake our desires, that we give them up. So think of it this way. Stoicism, like skepticism and the unhappy consciousness, are kind of defense mechanisms that masters cannot be themselves satisfied because they are recognized by folk who they regard as unworthy of recognizing them. Because the slave possesses an inwardness, a kind of incipient subjectivity, then the slave has an interiority. That the master has no access to. So the attempt here at unifying my worldview occur here in thought alone, because the outer world is inhospitable to the exercise of my freedom. It doesn't agree with what I wish it to be. So we understand the emergence of the meaning of freedom as constituted by this dissatisfaction with the world and a retreat inward. It's not an accident that people have talked about autonomy as an inner citadel. So freedom emerges as a constitutive own idea only in the context that makes the realization of freedom inhospitable, impossible. The slave, we know, has two models of independence. On the one hand, the master, and on the other hand, the object created. Independence is reflected in the object created as a self-enclosed object that is impervious to pain, which is why to become an in itself can feel like a ideal worth pursuing, of questing after, become indifferent to pain, to happiness, to the world. Even Socrates is always presented as this way, as the perfect Stoic. Doesn't notice, stands on one foot. Why do you stand on one foot? Anyway, standing on one foot, not noticing the hot, the cold, that he's awake, or is just standing there. The master is a limited model because the master is not really independent. In thinking I am free because I am not in the other. In the making of objects, there is a learning of independence, and that...
And that's because one of the things that Slate learns in working on the object is the meaning of universals, as the forms or shapes of the ideas for which the object is created.
The master can own the object, but not the concept. So thinking here means thinking the concept, the notion, the universal. Engel will say the true and the good. So the thought, or the plan, or the idea is my essence. Thinking is my essence. So the idea here is that freedom is the freedom of the concept. And that is an indifference to the particularity of things. So the abstract thinking of the Stoic is a turning its back on individuality altogether, an inhabiting of the universal. A becoming, we might say, a transcendental consciousness without an empirical corollary. Let me press this thought another way. In his account of Stoicism, John Russell says that, or begins his chapter by saying, we are all essentially Stoics. And this is shown by the simple fact that we can say, I. The saying of I is what shows one to be a free self-consciousness. Why saying I is enough? Because in saying I claim what is essential about me. And what I say is essential about me is what is within my control. So this primitive idea of the I am I just insofar as I am in control. What is absolutely my freedom that cannot be touched. Now, the only thing of mine that I can remain free is my thinking. I can't control my body completely. Others can heave me about. I suffer pains and bruises. So I becomes the thought of the self independently of the body. So there's a famous story about Epictetus where the master was twisting his leg and Epictetus says, if you go on, please be quiet. If you will go on like that, you're going to break my leg. The master goes on. Loud crack of the leg breaking. And he says, I told you so. That's the Stoicism. Now, how deep is that thought? Well, Epictetus, as has a saying that I believe is equivalent to the claim of eternal return in Nietzsche, which is a purely stoical doctrine, in my view. Epictetus says that you should not seek for things that happen. You should not seek for the things that happen to happen as you wish. That is, you should not seek to have the world go as you want it to go, because you're bound to be disappointed. You know, you can wish and want that you will, you know, win the lottery, but the chances are not good. You know, you can wish and want a lot of things, but if you're not going to wish or want the world to go as you wish or want it to go, then what are you supposed to will? And Epictetus says, you should wish that things happen as they do happen, and you will go along well. You should wish that things happen as they do happen. Or can you ask yourself, if this moment were to occur over and over again for an eternity, could you say yes to it? Same thought. Nietzsche's thought is nothing but the stoical thought of, and he loved, by the way, the thought of eternal return is just the stoical principle itself. And nothing more, I think. Bad news for Nietzscheans.
Jay, I'm not sure I'm able to ask this.
Could you
elaborate a little bit in some kind of stoicism on the relationship between thought and will? It seems to me that at times in the account you just gave, the two will collapse into one another. And thought, if I understand the account Hill gives in these pages, is, as you said, grasping universals. And will seems to me to be different. And there is an element in Stoicism of the self-interrogation of the will as an activity that would be hard for me to understand as the grasping of universes. Seneca asking himself at the end of the day, how have I been? What have I done? What would I do differently tomorrow? How did I treat my friend? You know, all those kinds of things.
Right. So what Hegel thinks is the following. He thinks that the gap between the freedom of thought and the freedom of the will is actually hard to make out here. That he actually doesn't see, or the Stoic, in his view, the Stoic does not see a significant difference between the two. And the reason that the Stoic doesn't see a significant difference between the two is because of the relation of control. So, the Stoic, does not think of universals as independent of the movement of his thoughts. And he does not think of universals as independent of the movement of his thought, because, this is absolutely central to this, the universals are so abstract, which is when Hegel says that the universals are merely the notion of the true and the good. So universals are not the universals of concrete kinds. It's not, you know, thinking about redness and cupness. No, no, no. It's we might say, only categorical thoughts, the one, the true, the good. That is thought. And these thoughts allow me to then ask of any. So they become my thinking measure. They are equal to the self's thinking of its comportment to any possible range of objects, and they count as nil in relationship to the authority of the true and the good, which I identify myself with. So that the point is nothing determinate has a grip on me. That's what draws will and thought together. The absence of determinacy. And therefore, there's a certain model of freedom. What they share is a certain freedom from determinacy. So it's negative freedom. And negative freedom turns out to look like to both the freedom of thought and the freedom of the will itself, where freedom of will is not different from the freedom of thought. It's just that...
So the point of the universe is the freedom from determinacy.
Yeah.
That's why the fact of the one true good and those kinds of things.
Exactly. And that is what I can control. Therefore, that is my will. Therefore, I am free from determinacy. Therefore, so let's just turn. Let's turn briefly to the text, and then we'll have a break just to take over the text sentence. Louise, going slower than I anticipated. So Hegel says in. The opening paragraph, paragraph 197 on page 120, that the moment of intrinsic being or thinghood, which received its form and being fashioned, is no other than substance, no other substance than consciousness. So that's the moment of transition. The form of the thing is consciousness. And then he can go on to say, or Hegel can go on to say, for to think does not mean to be an abstract I, but an I which has at the same time the significance of intrinsic being having itself for object, or of relating itself to objective being in such a way that its significance is being for self of the consciousness for which it is an object. For in thinking, the object does not present itself in picture thoughts, but in notions, i.e. in distinct being in itself or intrinsic being, the conscious, etc. So there's a distinction drawn here, and it will come back to be central in the chapter on religion, miles from here, of the distinction between conceptual thinking and picture thoughts, images. Only concepts are free. Picture thinking is no better than sensory awareness itself. And therefore he has this long jag against picture thinking. But then he will go on to say, in thinking I am free because I am not in another, but remain simply and solely in communion with myself, and the object which is for me the essential being, is an undivided unity of my being for myself. And my activity is conceptual. So the aim, he says here, is to be free. And the aim of freedom is to repudiate all dependence. In paragraph 200, page 122, he says, yet, at the same time, top of the page, this, its essence, is only an abstract essence. The freedom of self-consciousness is indifferent to natural existence and is therefore, let this equally go free. The reflection is a twofold one. Freedom in thought has only pure thought as its truth, a truth lacking the fullness of life. Hence, freedom in thought, too, is only the notion of freedom, not the living reality of freedom.
So, Stoicism depends upon a radical dualism
between thinking and world, and it repudiates any connection between self and world, which is why this is equally, as Russian rightly points out, the same argument you can find in Epictetus or in Sartre's existentialism and humanism. It's still that notion of radical independence for itself versus the in itself. Freedom versus thing.
Well, if I only have the notions of the true and the good to think about, and therefore my thinking is my thinking of myself, that I'm in, again, communion with myself again.
So the Stoic is, as one always suspects of Nietzsche, a wild form of narcissism with no exteriority. What is it that could lead out of it? If Stoicism is this thought of radical independence, nothing touches me, I'm in communion with myself. And if even in that exquisite moment of pain, Epictetus can say, I told you so. So it's not a being, it's not going to be an empirical experience is not going to make the difference. Bring it on! It's nothing. How is this going to get shifted?
Boredom
is what Hegel says. If you have nothing to think about but yourself forever and ever, then eventually it will just, and keep saying a mantra, this is true, this is good. And eventually you'll just die of boredom. So what ends Stoicism for Hegel is not some interruption, but the fact that essentially nothing happens. And that's the problem, is that it lacks any determinacy, and it's freeing itself from any determinacy makes it absolutely empty. So you can have the freedom of thought, but if all you have is the freedom of thought...
I thought it meant that boredom was then determinate. Okay, I think that's kind of an interesting definition of boredom being presented, which is that boredom turns out for the stone to be determinate. Not that boredom is something that one arrives at, like a kind of nirvana, because saying true good...
Oh, no, mantra, right. No,
it
no,
turns
no.
out that there is actually something determinate, namely that one encounters this thing called boredom, which is unbearable.
Right. No. I think that is exactly Hegel's thought. Yeah. One is brought to a mood that one cannot control. Which, of course, I take it to be a direct corollary of eternal return. Right. Do you really want this moment over and over again? The problem is not that I can affirm it. It would just be tedious. Okay, speaking of tedious, let's have a break. And we will see if we can find the second.